This is the 12 Songs of Christmas, today with Lowland Hum. My name is Alex Rawls, and today I'm talking to Lauren and Daniel Gones of Charlottesville, Virginia, who perform as Lowland Hum. If you check them out on social media, you'll often find their posts tagged Support Quiet Music, and in their case, when you hear it, it's pretty clear. It's not just a volume level, but it's actually sort of an aesthetic, and we talk about that both as an idea and as a reality in our conversation. They have their fourth album due out this spring, titled Glyphonic, and we touch on it as we talk about the duo's 2017 album of Christmas music, Songs for Christmas Time. I actually found the band while looking around on SoundCloud for Christmas songs, and I ran across their version of Christmas Time Is Here, and it became one of my go-to songs for the last Christmas season. The purity and clarity of Lauren Gones' voice made the song, which has, I always think, very sort of stylized, self-consciously Spartan lyrics, still feel like a very personal expression. And we talk about that, and my affection for Christmas Time Is Here as a part of our talk in a bit. Our conversation took some interesting twists and turns as we talked about quiet music, folk music, and the things that shape their music for Christmas and the rest of the year. We also talked briefly about the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, but since they weren't there, and so they had nothing firsthand to add to what we already know, I left it out of the final cut. It didn't really make sense in a conversation on Christmas music unless they had something sort of fresh and special to add. So anyway, here's my talk with Lauren and Daniel Gones of Lowland Hum. One of the things I saw when I was reading to prepare for this was the hashtag Support Quiet Music, which makes quiet music sound like a philosophical as well as an aesthetic decision. What's the idea behind it for you?
I think really early on in our career, we were playing with a band. And then when we stepped away from that, we realized that our goals were still to create the same kind of dynamic shapes in our songs, but with a lot less sound. And so in order to do that, silence becomes one of the things that you use, and space. And, when you're making music that has less going on and that does utilize silence and space like that, it requires a different kind of attention. And so pretty quickly after realizing that, it really wasn't about what we were making only. It did kind of become this thing where we realized that it takes a particular kind of listening and a particular kind of environment for quiet music to be meaningfully interacted with. And so we started thinking like we wanted to make some merch items and kind of start talking about like this idea of Support Quiet Music. Not in a way that's specific to our band, but just kind of as an idea that like this music, there are less spaces in the culture where this music can be experienced or heard.
Because of like the practical fact that it's easily overpowered by, you know, chatter and bar noise and even just coffee shop noise, any noise really.
And for me, when I'm thinking about it, I talk a lot, and Lauren is much quieter by nature. So a kind of very easy way for me to understand it is like, if I don't actively leave space in a conversation, Lauren will not insert herself into that conversation, and the conversation will be much less rich without her presence in it. So it's kind of a similar, for me, when I'm thinking about what this is about, it's a similar thing. It's sort of like, let's leave some space for the kind of music being made that would not turn your head.
Or just leave space for things that would otherwise be easily drowned out.
Yeah, exactly.
Does that extend into other parts of your creativity and sort of other parts of your life? Like, I wonder, does that get to a place where you create sort of more quiet graphics and more quiet designs when you're thinking about merch and when you're thinking about a life, the way you lead your life? Does that sort of like trying to think of a less busy or less cluttered way to live? Does quiet extend beyond just a musical concept?
I would say that it does. I think, I do all of our design work, and I always try to create things that feel consistent with the sound that we're making. But I also think, like, we are bombarded with so much imagery and stimuli that, in many ways, I want the visual components of what we put out into the world to also be sort of a respite, in the same way that quiet music often creates spaces that are respites for us and for others. And I do think more recently in our personal lives, we are trying to create more empty space and space for things to... space for processing and space for contemplation. And for most people, I would imagine, but for us too, it's just so easy for everything to get filled to the brim. And now we can work when we're in the car, as long as we're not driving, hopefully, when we're, you know, waiting on a food order or something like that, we can always fill that space because of technology. And so I do think more recent, like maybe the past year or so, we've been trying to be more intentional about leaving space in our lives, because I think we're missing something.
Now, from what I read, you recorded, is it Gilphonic? Is that correct?
Glyphonic.
Glyphonic. Okay. All right. I think. All right. Let me catch up. Anyway, you recorded Glyphonic, if I see this right, on the top floor of a building. Is that right?
Go
ahead.
Yeah, we lived in an apartment that was on the third floor of this building in downtown Charlottesville at that time. And we recorded it in our apartment.
So one thing that strikes me as interesting is that while on one hand you're sort of making prioritizing quiet, when it seemed like if you're recording in your apartment that you're also a little bit at the mercy of the ambient sounds of the city. How do those two pieces fit together for you?
Yeah, it's really interesting. We actually, the reason we made Glyphonic in the library is because we made the Christmas record up there and we felt familiar with the sounds. We felt familiar with how to capture sound in that space.
And as long as there wasn't a lot of noise pollution, it was a good space for recording, but there was a lot of noise pollution. Sorry, I interrupted you, Dan.
No, that's fine. It's kind of a hilarious juxtaposition because we were playing stuff that was so quiet that almost any noise would get on the recording. So like, for instance, there's a parking lot behind the building. Every time someone locked their car, it would, you know, do the like boop boop thing. And like the guitar parts were so quiet that I would always be like, oh, it was just like a car door locking. It's fine. And then we'd like play it back and be like, well, no, we need to retract that. And so we started getting up at 4:30 and 5 in the morning. We would track from, you know, from then until about 8:30 when people started arriving for work. And then we'd take about an hour and a half break until people were kind of settled into the offices. And then we'd work for another couple hours till lunch break. And then we kind of started arranging our days around other people's activity,
oh, that's
which
great.
It was kind of a strange experience. Like and we had to record by candlelight because the lights in the room, the lights in the apartment made noise. There was kind of a humming coming out of the lights. So we were like recording in the pitch black by candlelight. It was kind of hilarious, but also really kind of, meditative in a way. It was really, I don't know. I think it influenced the sound, of this new record. So it's kind of interesting.
I have to say, I have much the same kind of affection for that time of morning. That I have a wife and daughter, and if I need to get something done, I wake up early. And I've realized that email doesn't start showing up until 6 o'clock. And so if I get up between 4 and 5, I can get a full hour, hour and a half with really no distractions. That's kind of, that kind of space in our world is really rare.
Totally. Mm-hmm. Totally.
So yep. Do you find that working in a sort of working outside of conventional studios and working perhaps in more domestic spaces suits your music better?
I think so. I mean, I definitely think there could be places where it might be easier to capture clean sound, but I do think that we like to take our time, and in the studio, you're paying for every hour and every day. I mean, you're usually paying by the day, but that just makes you feel like you have to cram as much as you can in that day to make it worth your money. And I really don't like that kind of pressure on the creative process. Although sometimes pressure and limitation can be like a good challenge. I don't know, Daniel, do you have thoughts? Because Daniel produces for other people, and he does often rent studios when he's working with other artists. Especially if it's a full band thing. So you should speak on that, I think.
I actually think, so we're working on putting together our own studio now.
We moved out to the country over the summer. So that quiet is more readily available, but continue, Daniel.
Yeah. So after leaving that apartment, we moved out to the country and we are putting together our own studio. And I think it will be really fun to create in that space. But I do think the guy who made my guitar, he has this belief that there are different songs in different guitars. And so he thinks that if he, like, for instance, if he lent me another one of the guitars that he made for a couple weeks and I wrote songs, the songs would be totally different than the songs I would have written on my original guitar. And I kind of feel that way about spaces also. So, like, I think our apartment, where we used to live, we lived in our landlady's library. So we were surrounded by like floor to ceiling by all of her books, and being surrounded by this environment that she had set up and all these titles that kind of shape her knowledge and her areas of expertise, I do think really influenced the record. And I think, or the last two records that we made up there. And the record we did before that, we did in a friend of ours' attic. And I do think for these last 3 years, those domestic spaces that were put together by people that aren't us, I think really influenced us. And I think helped us discover new elements to the music that we make together. So I think it has been really good for us musically. But as Lauren said, I think it was somewhat out of necessity at first, but in hindsight, I see how it also helped us to innovate in ways I think we wouldn't have if we had more tools at our fingertips, like in a traditional studio.
Fun for all that you.
So obviously one thing I wanted to talk about was obviously your Christmas record, Songs for Christmas Time, which was 2017. And on it you recorded Christmas Time Is Here. And I wonder what inspired you to cover that song?
Well, the Vince Guaraldi Charlie Brown Christmas album is probably my favorite, one of my favorites since I was a little kid. And that song is so melancholy. And I think we both really appreciate that about that song, that there would be a song that makes space for some of the more complex emotions sometimes you feel around the holidays. Whether it's because you're remembering people that are no longer with you, or relationships that are strained, or any number of things that make the holidays not simply joyful or beautiful. I don't know. It's a beautiful song and also a sad song, sort of, even though the lyrics are actually not sad. We just really appreciate that about it. And I think that was one of the first songs that's the first Christmas song we ever learned together.
Yeah, and the changes have a kind of beautiful tension and release.
The chord changes.
The chord changes and where the vocal melody falls. There's a lot of complexity to it emotionally, I think. It feels kind of like, I don't know, it feels kind of like traveling. Like I think about I went to University of North Carolina for school, and when I was there, I did an independent study on James Taylor. And I remember there are all these people around the world, and James Taylor's voice for them sounds like home. But that is very odd because he's obviously from a very different place. And, you know, for him, if he's singing about home, it's North Carolina or Massachusetts. But somehow certain tones take you to places that are significant to in your memory, even though the tone may take someone else to, you know, a completely different place. And I don't know. I'm just trying to say that I think the melodies and where they fall on the chord changes on that song seem to create space for any number of emotions. In a time where a lot of the music that you hear when you're going to different stores and different things is sort of in a very sort of limited emotional space. And it's somewhat sugary.
No, I think you're right. I think one thing I as you were started to talk about the song's melancholy, that I was thinking, it's a melancholy song, but there's nothing melancholy in the lyrics. It's Guaraldi's piano and that vocal line that mm-hmm. give it all of that, and how rare complicated emotions are in Christmas songs.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The thing I think is really, you know, sort of accompanying that I think is interesting is, I would think this also goes back to just the Charlie Brown Christmas, is that, you know, in a piece of entertainment for children, you have a level of complexity that really is far more aimed at adults. And how few Christmas songs are actually pitched mm-hmm. towards adults, or pitched towards, you know, towards any kind of complicated emotion.
Yeah,
that's a great point. I've never thought of that.
I haven't
way
either. Yeah.
What was your take on the Charlie Brown Christmas?
Oh, I think it's wonderful.
I love it too. I only saw it for the first time 2 years ago.
Oh, wow.
I don't know how. I just
missed that growing up.
I missed
somehow.
It. Yeah. My family didn't watch that. I don't know why. But we watched it all together a few years ago, and I love it. I think it's hilarious, and it's really clever. I don't know. It's great. It's really special.
Yeah. I can't separate it, you know, from, like, I can't remember when I didn't watch it.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I don't think I've ever loved it, because even as a kid, that sort of the melancholy of it, just how punishing everybody is on Charlie Brown,
Even when you know the Peanuts, you know, the Peanuts, you know, world, and I read comic strips, so I was, you know, I was reading Peanuts then, and still just the overwhelming darkness of it and the yeah. sense of, you know, this the degree to which Charlie Brown was just brutalized was really, you know, it was always hard to entirely get with. And but at the same time, I didn't miss it. You know, like every year I watched it again, and so it's one of those pieces of sort of Christmas entertainment that I find deeply fascinating, and obviously it's been a major part of my life. Yeah. But it's one of those things I could never entirely sort of get next to, just because, you know, having the sort of the cruelty of kids that are is in Peanuts, having it actually come out of kids' mouths.
Yeah.
Like,
that's a little tougher than so.
I know. Yeah. I remember as a kid not totally I don't know, it didn't really resonate with me much when I was younger, but for some reason, I guess last year we were kind of sad over Christmas about various things, and it really resonated with me. More so, I think too, because even in the midst of our sadness, we were able to see, like, there's so much we have to be thankful for. And I think from the outside, if anyone knew we were sad, they'd just think it was ridiculous or whatever. So some of the insensitivity of the kids, I don't know, it just kind of, I think it hit us both last year more than normal.
You can tell me, Lauren, when it seems like on one hand, that vocal melody doesn't allow you a lot of leeway. It seems like I've heard so many versions of it that are where people are really not interpreting in big ways. But at the same time, it's pretty clear that the vocalist and your approach to the material is pretty crucial to the success of that as a song. Am I right? Or you tell me about it from your perspective as the singer, how you dealt with that song.
This might be a little abstract, but I think when singing it and when delivering the vocals, I kind of tried to let myself go to the space in my mind where that song takes me, and go from there. I don't think I do much to change the melody from the original, except for maybe to allow it to be potentially even sleepier sounding than it does in the original. But yeah, I mean, I think I, in my mind, that song just conjures, although it leaves space for sort of complex emotions, it also conjures really beautiful imagery, some of which, overlapping with like imagery from my childhood and my own memories. And, so I don't know if that answers your question, but I just kind of try to tap into where the original takes me in my mind and deliver those lines from there.
Yeah. What I was thinking about was, and I think you sort of did, I guess what I particularly like about responded to in your version was just sort of how plain spoken it was, that it almost didn't sound like a song. If, you know, the structure didn't tell you this is a song, it sounds awfully close to you to feeling like you're communicating really directly with me, as opposed to, you know, here's a melodic line that I am following, and here's a set of changes I'm singing over.
That's really
go ahead.
No, I was just saying that's really interesting. I love hearing that. That's cool.
But I was, you know, the thing is, so many people sing that song essentially the same way. I've heard very few people play with the melody or play with the timing of it. And so you know, on one hand, sort of every, you know, people produce sort of a similar thing, but then at the same time, there's something in the way they do it that clearly marks versions as being very different.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was just trying to see if I could sort out where that came from. And is it hard to take liberties with that melody?
I think so. I don't know. It's funny. I haven't really considered. It's like it didn't even occur to me to change the melody when we were
arranging it.
Yeah, it's the melody. I changed some of the chords. It's the melody that you need about that song.
Yeah,
it's
like, the melody is what seals it for me as just an essential in my life. So I guess maybe that's why I didn't even consider changing it. I don't know.
Well, something I also like about Lauren's voice is I think there's a clarity, kind of unadulterated purity to the tone of her voice. It's like closer to a bell than to a, almost than to a voice or something. It's like I think things do pass through her untouched more than other singers that I've worked with before. I'm also married to her. And so I know it's not, I know it's biased, but I really do think that. I think there's a way that she handles melody with a care and precision that I actually don't have access to that. That's not the kind of voice I have. So it's been really wonderful to learn from her in that way. And I think it's a very respectful way to approach someone's melody.
Right.
My general singing style is one that doesn't, I don't want to sing in such a way that if you were to hear me speak, you'd be like, whoa, why does their speaking voice sound so different from their singing voice? I don't know. I do want the way that I naturally sound to come through my singing voice. And I know that there are a lot of maybe interesting decisions one can make when it comes to how to color your voice or affect your voice so that it sounds maybe more interesting. And sometimes that is a great creative choice. But for me, I generally steer clear of that kind of thing. A voice is such a personal thing and such an intimate thing. Everyone has a voice that comes out of them that they can't really control. I guess you can control the way your voice. I mean, I'm just referring to your speaking voice at this moment. But I think that artistically and creatively, it's important to me that Daniel and I offer ourselves to people in a way that's honest. And I feel like, of course, you can like train and do work on your voice, I guess, to improve some things. But I like the idea of the person really coming through. In almost any art, the art I love is when I can get a sense of the person behind it. So I feel like, I don't know, I'm kind of rambling, but does that make sense?
No, yeah, I follow entirely. So Daniel, a moment ago you talked about, you know, changing a few chords in Christmas Time Is Here. And the one place where I thought where I could most obviously hear some changes was in your arrangement of Joy to the World. Can you tell me what you did in that? Because I know I'm definitely hear a guitar drone that I didn't expect. It sounds like there's a few changes. So can you walk through what you did with that?
Yeah. So I kind of like, it's not exactly taken all the way to a minor key, but it's kind of like, I think it's kind of like I added a ninth. But basically if you're playing a traditional C shape, on the guitar and you just remove your index finger, it kind of has this more open sort of almost minor feeling to it. And what I did was actually play all the chords of the song, in that you know, with that kind of with those strings open. So it would be especially the B and the B string and the E string were open. So it's kind of like this, there's a lot more tensions and the notes are interacting differently than when you're playing a traditional C chord where it's just 1-3-5, you know, C, E, G. Anyway, I don't know if that makes sense, but basically by doing that, it kind of takes into a different emotional space. And I think as a result of all the touring we've done and other things in our personal lives, things that feel really triumphant don't exactly resonate. And I think that even singing a song as straightforwardly triumphant as Joy to the World, it felt like we could inhabit the song more completely if there were other kind of resonances in there, if that makes sense.
Sure.
Really what we did when we started arranging songs for the Christmas album was we started trying to play them a way we'd never heard them played. And if it started feeling like there was momentum in that idea, we tried tons of different Christmas songs before we started recording, just kind of playing through them and trying different time signatures or chord changes or turning it to minor or major and trying to feel out, what arrangements of this song could we inhabit that aren't exactly what we've heard before. There's so many great Christmas recordings that, in fact, in the back of my mind, I was thinking if we can't find a full set of songs that we can inhabit, there's plenty of great Christmas records out there and we just won't make one. I do think that was that Joy to the World when we first played it in that with those kind of more tense chords or even kind of minor kind of things shifted to minor. It just felt, I don't know. We felt like we could be in it, be at home in it.
So as I was preparing for this conversation, I saw references to your faith. If you don't mind me asking, are you Christian?
Yeah, we are. I think, that can mean a lot of different things,
sure.
But we do have contemplative practice and we do think, we do know that, or we do believe that God is real and, you know, we believe in the Christmas story. And I think for many of the people that we know who don't, many of our friends don't share our faith and much of the language surrounding faith to them sounds like hatred, which has been, it's very painful, but it also, we try to be very careful in how we talk about it because of that.
Sure. Yeah. Part of the reason I ask is in part because so few people I talk to either are, or if they aren't, or if they are, they're guarded about it, which is understandable in the popular music context that, you know, being an artist who is a Christian too often means it's conflated to be a Christian artist, and that becomes sort of the end of the story and becomes drastically limiting in terms of who's listening.
Right.
So,
totally.
So I understand, but why I want to give you the option, but ask before I talked about it. But how did your position? How did that affect your choice of songs for the album?
I think, that's a really good question, and thank you for your sensitivity on that. I think, I think just to go back a little bit, I think the more, I don't know, it's so funny how many different things it can mean when if you just tell someone that you are a Christian, and just like I totally agree with what you're saying about the arts, it's kind of like there's this whole separate industry of Christian music that really we've had no interaction with at all, I think the way that our faith affected the songs that we chose, a lot of this kind of triumphant and really like honestly really joyful and celebratory recordings and treatments of the hymns, Christmas hymns and Christmas songs, almost impede our ability to lean into the Advent season or trying to really think about the power of that story. So I think, you know, some of our favorite Christmas records are that Seeger Sisters Christmas record, if you've heard that.
Yes.
That's one of our favorites, and we love John Fahey's guitar Christmas records. But these ones that create more of a kind of more of a contemplative space, and where there is more room for things all along the spectrum. To create a record where people at all different places in that spectrum would feel welcome.
Yeah, I think too. I don't know if we've just like had a sobering couple of years or something, but I think we've just more recently found a lot of Christmas hymns and Christmas songs to often, the tone often feels kind of manic to me. And I think we were trying to choose songs that like Daniel said, accommodate more emotions on the spectrum. And even lyrically, even though some of them lyrically, I feel like do have a very joyful tone. We just wanted to make music that made space for other things. 'Cause even the story of Christmas is like one that has a lot of scary, mysterious, hard things in it, and joyful, beautiful things in it too. But, we just wanted to leave more space for that. I don't know if all of this rambling answers your questions.
No, that makes total sense. And in many ways, it's sort of that same. You know, I was really always very sort of considered myself very lucky because my grandfather was a Baptist minister.
Okay.
And at the same, but he's also somebody whose mind was opened by his faith rather than closed by it. When I run into in life people for whom, you know, their faith makes them, you know, lean towards being judgmental, it's always very handy and kind of grounding to realize that's them. That's not endemic in their faith. That's those people and how they use their faith. And so the idea at the same time that your faith says, you know, makes you want to leave space in that rather than push home the we won or something. I think the manic is a great way to think about it. Think about some of those songs, and as beautiful as they are, there is so much going on. And so I could hear, I hadn't thought of it in those terms, but that made real sense, that to try to find ways to sort of clear out space so you can hear kind of the human heart of those songs.
Mm, yeah. And I do think, like, kind of what you're saying about the way different people kind of use their faith, I do think, like, to me, one of the messages of Christmas and of the Christmas story is radical hospitality. And I guess in that way, like, we did approach these songs thinking, like, how can we make these hospitable to all people? And no matter what they believe, or no matter where they are emotionally right now, or we wanted them to feel empathetic. Maybe they're not super hospitable to people who are on an emotional high.
But those people are all right.
Yeah. Johnny Cash's We Are the Shepherds?
I think Johnny Cash, I think some of his Christmas recordings have a real humility to them. You know, he's kind of known as sort of like, you know, a badass dude, but there's a real humility to a lot of his recordings, and a real, although the arrangements are kind of, you know, the arrangements are, you know, big and orchestral sometimes, and you know, large in scope, there's this kind of understated humility to some of his delivery. And also on some of his Christmas records, he talks in between the songs about all these experiences that he's had, and these kind of myth, almost like mythical experiences of the spirit of Christmas. And he always connects it back to almost like the way of Christ in the world, but it's connected to a lot of people experiencing poverty. And I don't know, he's been very significant for me at different times. When I was in my 20s, I wore all black for 3 years because I read this thing he wrote about how regardless of where you are in your career, whatever audience you're playing for needs a reminder that some people are in mourning, some people are in prison, some people are not where you are. And I was like, that's the best reason I've ever heard to wear clothing of a certain kind, so I'm going to do it. So I was a pretty extreme young dude, but I just think some of his empathy and soft-heartedness for the downtrodden, and, you know, in this case, the shepherds, him telling the whole story from their perspective and all connected to this candle. There's one way I can look at it where I'm like, it's kind of cheesy, but on this other end, it really seems powerful for somebody who was at the height of where you could ever get musically in terms of fame and achievement, recording these very humble and writing this very humble song. So just kind of, I don't know, it seems to point to a deeper understanding of what actually is substantial and what actually matters.
So here is the stable, and there is the manger. The new Savior sleeps on his first earthly night. The wise men brought riches, but we brought a candle. It's all that we have, but it gives a good light.
It's also set to the tune of Streets of Laredo, which is like a cowboy ballad.
Yeah, we also like cowboy songs. Yeah.
So I thought that was fun. I was like, why does this Christmas song feel like something I've heard before?
That was great.
And we made the connection. But yeah, I agree with and stand behind what Daniel was just saying too. Yeah. There is like humility and humanity. It comes, I don't know, something about the way he sings, those things come through in a beautiful way.
See, that's interesting to me. I have to say, I hear those songs differently, but I know what you're saying. That what you're hearing, humility. To me, it sounds a little bit like almost childlike in its simplicity. The way those songs break down to really the lines break down to really simple sentences,
uh-huh,
and totally. that and how they're kind of they're all that the lines are all very solitary thoughts that add up to sort of simple thoughts, simple lines to tell a straightforward story. And I appreciate it, and you give me reason to think. It makes me think now, you know, that his voice is what makes that song go. I had thought prior to yours that his voice was what made those songs go. But clearly, there's a little more life inside those songs than I entirely connected to, because I've found, you know, there's chunks of his material that I admire, but he could be cheesy.
There's a lot. I mean, honestly, there's a lot that he has made that doesn't resonate at all. And out of all the Christmas songs that we listen to, you know, it's not that I think the songwriting is particularly strong on that song. Honestly, that's not my belief. But I just think there's something going on there. Like you're saying, the childlikeness, it's almost like, I don't know, this will seem non sequitur, but it's not. Have you seen the Mr. Rogers documentary?
Not yet. I want to watch it.
Well, after I watched it, I thought that Mr. Rogers was like more punk rock than punk rock.
Right.
And it's sort of a similar thing, like a person who doesn't have to be vulnerable at all, who has their own TV show and is as famous as you can get. They don't have to write a childlike song. In fact, they could just write the same kind of thing over and over and make tons of money doing that and continue to get respect doing that. But there's something interesting about something being so simple. I don't know. Maybe, and I could be reading into it because maybe, you know, for any number of reasons, I want to think it's cool. But I think there might be something there.
How do you step into a Johnny Cash song?
I think because that melody was already kind of like embedded in me from a Marty Robbins version of Streets of Laredo that I loved. I don't think I changed much. I don't know. It's funny. I've actually had to push myself to prioritize seeking out and listening to female writers and singers because I, for some reason, have always enjoyed male voices more. So I don't know. I don't know if that's why you're asking, because it's a man singing it.
More I actually ask because it's a very specific man with a very specific voice, but it may well be that you simply singing the song is automatically transformative.
Yeah. I don't know. I think some of my beginnings in singing and in music was in chorus, and I was always an alto, and so I was always the harmony. So I'm kind of always, when I'm listening to music I'm familiar with, like when I'm driving around in the car by myself, I tend to often sing along with it and sing a harmony no matter who's singing it. So I don't often think much about how would I translate, you know, this person's very distinctive voice into my own singing, because I'm just always singing with recordings, I guess. I don't know.
So how does Songs for Christmas Time fit into your body of work, in your mind?
I think on our third album, Thin, we started to kind of realize that when we work together, there are these almost like sonic themes that are emerging. And I think we kind of dialed some of that in on Thin in a new way, partially because of limitation. Like we were saying, we were recording it in a guy's attic. And after we had made the record, we thought about, I wonder if we could put together a group of Christmas songs within the aesthetic of the album we just recorded. And so I don't know why, but for the last like 3 or 4 years, we've listened to a ton of bossa nova, and samba music, and, you know, and then kind of, we're coming from a more of a sort of like traditional folk perspective, but then you sort of mix in like the kind of singer-songwriter, early 70s singer-songwriter stuff. And that was sort of what was emerging on Thin. It's like really distilled, very simple music, sometimes just one guitar, a piano is in there for 20 seconds, and two vocals. And we thought about, could we arrange some of these really amazingly beautiful, almost expansive sounding Christmas hymns? Like Oh Holy Night was one of the first ones we were thinking about. Like, is there a way to do that song with this super limited treatment? And our idea approaching our third record was, let's make a record where basically what's recorded is only what we could do live as a duo.
Yeah.
So not 50 tracks, like 6 tracks or 4.
Yeah, we really tried to limit it to what we, with our two voices and two sets of hands, could do at one time for the most part. And I think when we applied that limitation, when we were making that album Thin in 2016, we found something that felt like it was part of the essence of what we make when it's the two of us creating. And so I think when we made songs for Christmas time, we were kind of carrying forward that palette, and like sonic palette, and we weren't as strict with the limitation of what can we only pull off with just our voices and our two, you know, sets of hands, but we still kind of kept that limitation in mind and kept the idea of space and quiet and distillation in mind.
Right. Now, I've heard Kiss the Ring and Salzburg Summer from Glyphonic, and neither of them are as spare as Thin or the Christmas songs.
Yeah.
Is that a reflection of where you are now or your thoughts about Christmas music?
You know, a lot of the songs on the new record, there's a handful of songs on the new record that are even more sparse than Thin or Songs for Christmas Time. But we did kind of allow things to open up a little bit more if it seemed like the song was asking for that. And those are two of the ones that are two of the more lush songs on the record. Or I shouldn't say lush, I guess I should just say there's more on those, more instruments, layering. More layering. I do think we feel like we're entering a new chapter in our lives. We moved out to the country. We're starting a little garden, working on having this little studio out here. And so I do think we are open to things shifting a little bit. But I really still think it's in the same universe.
Sure.
Yeah.
On a Friday, I sit in a room. In my head there's a tune, and I feel defeated by the speed machine and the social scene. I keep on waiting for something to happen. I am slow, and it's high time I am slowed down to feel the cost of all my movement.
So what does Glyphonic mean, by the way?
It is a made-up word that is, when we were thinking about what Glyphonic, what the album was, we felt like this album doesn't really, there isn't like an overarching theme that kind of weaves through all the songs or anything like that, but they are all sort of like snapshot stories, lots of imagery and a lot of little stories told with words and little pictures told with words. And so I thought of hieroglyphs, and those are stories told with pictures, like cave drawings and stuff. But then basically I tried to make up a word that communicated stories told through sound
and pictures told through sound. So that is what glyphonic means.
But also a lot of our, when we write together, a lot of the storytelling is imagistic instead of narrative.
Yeah.
So it'd be based on this kind of combination of images, and the story does come through, I think, but it's kind of like, it's rooted more in almost visual descriptions of visual things in the natural world many times. And I think that's kind of the combination of my English major sort of folk songwriting and Lauren's background in visual art sort of blending into this new thing. So when she said glyphonic, it was like, it instantly made sense to me that this group of songs kind of really fits under that umbrella more than anything we've ever made.
Thanks to Lauren and Daniel for the conversation and their candor. I really enjoyed that talk and getting to know their music as part of my prep for this conversation. You can hear Slow and Salzburg Summer from Glyphonic on SoundCloud and YouTube. The album is due out this spring. You can find them and me on Facebook. They're at Lowland Hum, and I'm at 12 Songs of Christmas. Also, thanks as always to New Orleans AF the Naysayer for the theme music and interstitial music. Let's wrap up with one more from Lowland Hum. This is Salzburg Summer. Talk to you soon.